So with whatever time we have left, questions, thoughts, yes?
I have never listened to your show, so I don't know exactly. I mean, I'm a public school teacher, and I see what's wrong with it, but I don't know if what I think is wrong is the same thing that you think is wrong. I support vouchers. I support the fact that the money should follow the child. What exactly is your philosophy? Like, why do you see public school as such a horrible thing?
I have a feeling this might be our only question, folks.
Hi, everyone. Today is June 27th, Sunday, 2010, and I am in my car driving back from Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. Beautiful, breathtaking Lancaster, New Hampshire, where I just attended Porkfest for the last, better part of the last 5 days. That's the Porcupine Freedom Festival put on by the Free State Project here in New Hampshire. And what a fantastic time. What a wonderful time. So a little bit of a review and an introduction to what will be a supplemental installment of School Sucks Podcast. Unfortunately, right now, I do not have too much in the oven, so to speak, as far as the upcoming shows in the Kids Are Not Defective series, just because I've been on vacation for 5 days and a few other things that are going on back in Manchester. But hopefully those shows will follow about a week after you hear this one. So let's talk about Porkfest. If you were there, it was a thrill to meet you. And if you weren't, hopefully you'll be there next year. So Ofer and I decided that we would have a vendor's table. It was cool because I got to meet and interact with a lot of people who are fans of the show. And I also got to interact with some skeptics, we'll call them. People who were kind of unsure of the whole end of public education thing. So I had a few animated conversations with some folks and was able to pull a couple of them into our camp. You know, typical questions like, well, how would you educate everybody? Kind of, but we worked through that. And, like I said, some good conversation while in the tent. The only really, unfortunate thing about being stuck in the tent throughout most of the daytime hours on, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday was I missed a lot of things that were going on outside of the tent, which seemed, from what I heard, to be a lot of fun. But it was a positive experience. On the left of me, at the table on my left, we had FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association. So I got to hear a lot of the conversations that were going on at that table. I learned a few things, which is good. And across from me, I had Larkin Rose, who I'm a big fan of, and we talked just a little bit. He was very open to the idea of coming on the show and doing an episode with me in the series that will follow this one that we'll probably be announcing relatively soon, but we have some more work to do with Kids Are Not Defective. And then to the right of me, I had the folks from Line Plot Productions who are doing the Silver Circle movie that I believe will be released in 2011, but they're doing a pretty involved PR campaign leading up to that movie. And this is a project that I'm actually very, very excited about. As I may have mentioned on the show before, I used to be very interested in the idea of making a documentary film about the subject of public education. When I started to pitch treatments to more mainstream film people, going back, as far as like 2 years, I got some really negative feedback. One person told me that I should try to be more like Michael Moore, which sucked. And I started to realize that if you listen to the content in School Sucks Podcast, it would be very, very hard to penetrate the mainstream, which I think with various media projects should be our goal. Right now, even if you move away from a documentary and go to a feature, you've at least blurred the lines a little bit where you're not being as direct and you can probably get away with a little bit more. Like The Matrix, for example, we've talked about the themes and the ideas that that movie presents a number of times. It's about, you know, these this institutionalized social and political control that we all live under. That film would not penetrate the mainstream as a documentary. It would not have had that kind of commercial success as a documentary. So you find a way to tell a story that basically suggests the same message. But like I was saying, Silver Circle is animated, so now you've put even another layer of separation between your message and the method for telling the story. This allows you to get away with even more, which I think is very cool. Now, Silver Circle is kind of taking a look, a critical look, at, you know, monetary policy in the United States, the Federal Reserve, the collapse of the dollar. And I'll definitely put some information about this project in the show notes because I think it's totally worth checking out, along with Fija and along with Larkin Rose and a few other people that I'll mention in a minute. I mean, if you think about what you can get away with animation, I mean, think about, and this is not a very good example, but just to make the point, think about a show like Family Guy. Could you imagine if they tried to do that as like a live action show with real actors? It would be outrageous if those people existed in real life. Imagine if those people were your neighbors. You'd be like, wow, what a bunch of assholes. Now, Seth MacFarlane can get away with all of this sort of lowball, cheap, sexist, and racial humor because he animates Family Guy. Imagine what we could get away with if we decided to use that medium to tell people the truth. So I'm very, very excited about this, the Silver Circle project. It's using a similar kind of animation that, the sort of motion capture or feature capture animation that was used in the, in Avatar. So I think as this technology, becomes more readily available, becomes more affordable, hopefully we'll see more people doing stuff like this. But I definitely volunteered my time to help out, Silver Circle because I think it's such an exciting, project. I think it's things like that that will eventually lead to the philosophy of liberty, something that most people have no idea about penetrating the mainstream. So let's see, what else can I tell you about my experience? Oh, you know what? One thing that we should totally talk about at Porkfest is the food. George Mandrick Skouras, he's a subscriber to the show. He throws us a little bit of money every month, but this guy, it's called George's Famous Baklava, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but famous for other food as well. I ate about 15 euros over the course of 3 days that he made, and French fries and Greek grilled cheese sandwiches, and super, super nice guy, you know, runs an agorist business that I think is really, really worth supporting, and never really considered myself a huge fan of baklava. I mean, baklava is delicious, but it's just not something that I crave. But this baklava that there was trays of it in the cabin that I was staying in. So I sampled quite a bit of it. Like, it was like all of the baklava you ever had in your entire life combined into one piece of baklava. It was amazing. It was just delicious. And there was a few other food vendors as well, you know, all agorist, not asking the government permission to do business, which I think is absolutely phenomenal, even if their food was shitty. But everyone's food was absolutely delicious. So it was great to get to meet George. We didn't get to talk as much as either of us wanted to, but it was cool to at least see his operation and sample his talent. So I stayed in a cabin. I was a guest of Jason Osborne, who was a big sponsor of this show, as well as a number of other things. And Jason and I were in a cabin with Jason Talley, who I met for the first time. Jason is from the Motorhome Diaries, another great project. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And currently, I think he's working with Free Agents. Put a link to that in the show notes. Also, Johnson Rice from Free Talk Live, who, interestingly enough, had a debate with Stefan Molyneux, of all people, on the topic of atheism versus agnosticism, of all topics. And I gotta hand it to the guy, you know, I'm an atheist, and I think agnosticism is kind of like, you know, a chicken shit position, but really, really, really held his own against Steph. I mean, any debate with somebody like Steph on, you know, going against atheism, if it lasts more than 4 or 5 minutes and it doesn't look like a mouse fighting a robot made out of mouse traps, you can call that a success. I mean, he stayed on, they did it on Free Talk Live on the air, and he, you know, kept it going for 3 hours. So tip of the hat to him. And it was great to get to spend more time with those guys. I had met Johnson at the Liberty Forum, but we didn't really talk so much. And I got to spend a little bit of time with Gardner. The only person that I really didn't get to connect with or, you know, sit down and have any kind of conversation with, who I was really looking forward to talking to, was Steph. We had a little bit of small talk. He came up to the School Sucks Project table in the tent. So that's too bad, but maybe sometime in the future. Overall, this was just an absolutely extraordinary event. The weather was kind of crappy, but the scenery was beautiful. The people were wonderful. I was so impressed with so many things that I saw there, which is why I'm just kind of ranting about all this stuff, including somebody who's been doing great work for a long time, Sam Dodson, with the Obscured Truth Network. I was hoping to get a chance to talk to Sam more, but judging by the speed he was walking everywhere he seemed to be going, it was easy to tell that his time was at a premium. He was doing a lot of video work, filming and documenting the events of Porkfest, and he has just the most incredible setup as far as like film equipment. He really, really takes it seriously. He really, really seems like he knows what he is he's doing. And as somebody who's always been interested in film, I was really, really impressed with everything that I saw him and Meg, who's also with OTN, what I saw them doing. And speaking of film, I also got to see the opening scene from the movie that I had been plugging on the show a while ago, Chaturum. The 8-year-old actress who's in the opening scene of the movie actually corrected me a couple of times on my pronunciation, so I'll make sure I get that right. But John Shaw was a great guy, and, you know, considering the fact that this movie was made on a shoestring budget, really just superb-looking film. You know, the photography looked good, the editing was sharp, the acting was good, the lighting was really good, which is lighting, cinematography, very, very, very important to filmmaking. It was a great time. And since I'm in this whole Free State Project mood, I wanted to give you today, just because I don't have any new content ready, something that I think will be new for a lot of you, which was my speech, my public speaking debut at the 2010 Liberty Forum, also put on by the Free State Project. The title of this speech was The Catastrophe of Conventional Wisdom. And if you're curious about today's beautiful piece of music that's been accompanying this monologue here, it is the theme from Brokeback Mountain by Gustavo Santaolalla. Just a fantastic piece of music and a film that I've never seen, but I understand that's a whole movie about camping in the mountains. So I thought it would be fitting for this. So this is my speech from the 2010 Liberty Forum, The Catastrophe of Conventional Wisdom. Since most people who listen to the show have not heard it, I would be really excited to hear your feedback. Thanks for listening, and take care.
Hey guys, so it's my pleasure to introduce to you today Brett the Nut. He's a New Hampshire native who has worked in the greater New England area in the field of education. He's a teacher and currently is a partner in a company that provides educational consulting services. So more importantly, though, he is the producer of the School Sucks podcast, which is a program that addresses, I think, the most critical issue that we face today on the road to the free and voluntary society. This insanity, this absurd notion that education has anything whatsoever to do with running our children through these meat-grinding prison indoctrination torture camps they call schools, where they're segregated by age and taught to obey arbitrary authority, where their curiosity, their creativity, their intelligence, their genius is sucked out of them on a daily basis. I encourage you all to listen to School Sucks podcast. Give it to your friends, your family, any children you have in your life. The topics covered there will help them to survive the process of growing up in this world, give them the questions they need to ask the adults in their lives, and hopefully they'll be able to survive with their minds and their spirits intact. Ladies and gentlemen, the oh so incredibly sexy and always classy Brett the Nut.
and of course for the introduction and for everything you do for the show and all the awesome stuff you do related to the Liberty Movement. It's greatly appreciated. And Jason pretty much did my speech for me, though. That was pretty much it. So the creativity, conformity, sexy, those are all my notes. So I'll take questions. But I thought it would be good. I assume that a lot of people are somewhat familiar with the show, but I thought in the event that some here are not, it would be worth going over some of the details. You know, first the tone and the approach. I like to think that at the core of the show, there's a pretty solid base of about 10 years of experience that I've had in education, and some additional research and evidence that's mixed into the presentation. I also like to think that around that core, it's kind of a soft and fluffy coating. In other words, I really, really hope that the show is accessible to the target audience, which is young people, either students who are in the public schools right now or in private schools. As we know, private schools are too much different, or recent graduates whose minds are still pretty full of that poison. So I know that they have a real thirst for entertainment, so that's always been a kind of a drive of the show, but the podcast itself, the audio, is really, you know, as I imagine it, it's really just the audio piece of what I envision as a much, much larger project. And, you know, obviously I'm grateful to be speaking here today, but, you know, when I think about what my ambition is for this, and then I look at, like, what we already have done, or everything we've seen to do so far, it kind of feels like to use a movie comparison, like the point in the mid-70s where somebody wrote down on a piece of paper, idea, ongoing war in space between Galactic Empire and group of rebels, some people have magic powers, work in some puppets, right? And obviously, you see that is the starting point and where that went. I'm not comparing School Sucks Podcast to Star Wars. People will always say, Brett, you compare everything to some nerdy movie. But I'm just saying, as far as scope is concerned, as far as, like, where I would want this to go, I really feel like it's very, very much at the beginning. And so that's the kind of the presentation. But one of my greatest motivations behind doing this, I think I would explain it like this. You know, I studied history, I taught history, I got into politics, and for years and years and years, the more I looked at this stuff, nothing seemed to really make any sense. There didn't seem to be any consistency. And then a few years back, when I started to become aware of the philosophy of liberty and the non-aggression principle, I was excited about this, and I wanted to share these ideas with the people first that I cared about, the people that I had the best relationships with. And I found that the response was pretty negative to the idea of the philosophy. I was really surprised because it seemed like after everything I had done and then found this, it was like, oh, this is obviously. But the ridicule, the outrage, the indignation, the discouragement that I felt when I started to present these ideas was at times overwhelming. And, you know, I often wondered if I had tried to do that in a different time, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, whenever, if I would have retreated. If when I was met with that kind of resistance in another time that I didn't have readily available all of these resources for information and communication and networking and connecting with people and sharing ideas, would I have retreated? Would I have gone back to someplace safe and socially acceptable? And it also kind of begs the question, too, like, as all throughout history, like, how many times has this happened? Like, how many people have, by themselves, come up with some idea that was incredibly innovative or potentially revolutionary or stood to, like, push everything forward, but it was just crushed under the weight of conventional wisdom in the time and the place where they were, the dogma, the popular mythology. And even though, you know, I've always thought that I had a fair amount of confidence in my intellect and my ability to express my beliefs and positions and then to defend those positions if necessary. I've always wondered that. Like, would I have just shrunk away from all this? Because it seemed to the first group of people that I presented it to, family, friends, and colleagues, to just be crazy and not a good idea at all. Don't go down that road. But to have the encouragement of, Free Talk Live, Free Domain Radio, the Free State Project, Wes Bertrand's work, the Complete Liberty, where people are saying, no, you've got it, violence is wrong. Keep going, you're good. I often worry about that. And, the idea all throughout history, I think, has been different things. Maybe 2,000 years ago, somebody, got together with some kind of social situation, said, I'm really getting into the science stuff, I'm starting to think maybe the Earth isn't like a flat plane that the entire universe is spinning around. Maybe a little bit later on, it was, that story about that woman who was made out of that guy's rib that one time, maybe that wasn't true. Later on, maybe slavery isn't the best thing to base an entire economy on, right up to the present day, where, maybe violence and aggression and predation and threats and theft is not how an entire society should run. But the idea that school sucks now is easy. It's such an easy idea to bring to people when your target audience is students. School's already done all of the work for me, pretty much. and I think that's worth pointing out that this has been, since I can remember, since I graduated from high school, 15 years ago, one of the most common catchphrases and adolescent slogans available. And maybe it's driven by a number of other realizations, suspicions, or feelings about their education. But too often, I think it exists only as, a quiet mumbling at the end of the day, today as an anonymous blog post, or even completely in silence as a thought. And really the goal of the show and the project is to take that idea, that sentiment, and project it outward, to amplify it, to prevent young people who are starting to get it, or at least suspect it, from retreating back to convention and back to safety and back to what they're being told is right and socially acceptable. But also to illustrate the real truth and power of that statement that school sucks. I mean, sure, it seems just like a bitter and reductive thing to say. We all know what sucking is. And it's just kind of become this pejorative adjective that gets attached to things that we don't like. But in reality, like I've said many times before, and I'll repeat here again, the best attributes that we have as human beings that lead to happiness and satisfaction and success are creativity, optimism, curiosity, and individuality. And that stuff is all there when we're 4 and 5 and 6. And when we're 18, for too many of us, it has vanished, or it is in some kind of deep remission. That's number one. And of course, number two is that school, public education, government education sucks off the productive capacity of any community where they put the school. There are no refunds. There's no, if you send your kid there and the kid doesn't get an education, which means they're, that's pretty standard, that's what happens, there's no refund. You're not getting anything back. And like I said, I just don't want people to retreat from that sentiment, young people, without recognizing how much truth and how much power it has. And, I had a pretty satisfying conversation with a young man last week on Skype. We were recording a little round table, a student named Michael out in Illinois. And he was telling me the story that happened to him in school recently, where he had some kind of an altercation with one of his teachers. So he fled from that scene and went to the computer lab of the school. And just in, frustration and anger, he sat down at one of the computers and he, opened up Google and put in the phrase, school sucks. And that was how he found the show, and then he listened to every episode. So, if that same scenario, unfortunate as it is, happens to, you know, a million more kids, we're in business. Right? And he told all his friends about it, and I actually contacted him because I saw him come up on, the Facebook page, and they, you know, they labeled their high school in Illinois, and 30 people from that school came up. So, I think that school sucks thing, that idea seems to be working so far, and I hope it continues. It obviously needs to happen, a lot more, but, it's a good indication that we're getting there. So, so far I've covered, first of all, these connections, this community of, you know, sharing ideas, bouncing off ideas, getting encouragement. And I think that, you know, this place where we all are right now is just a super example of that, the Liberty Forum. And I've also talked about my experience a little bit, of the discouragement that I've encountered from dealing with states. But I really believe that, we really can't overlook the fact that while we're at the Liberty Forum and we're encouraging each other and we're sharing ideas and we're having a good time, that more than 9 out of every 10 people who are not here are statists. We need to talk to them. I believe we really need to talk to them. We need to, engage them. And, I know the word libertarian covers a lot of things, and I know right now it's covering a lot more things than it should. If you're a voluntarist, I think you should be talking to minarchists. And I've never understood why voluntarists get so frustrated with minarchists, because, you know, my attitude is, they're on their way, for the most part. They're on their way. They're coming, or they get it. And I think minarchists should be talking to statists. And I'm not critical of minarchism, because that's the bridge. You know, I really see that's the bridge, and I think that everybody needs to be engaging people who have, different points of view. And if anybody just walked in here, maybe from another convention, I'm using this word statist a lot, and, kind of like, who is this maniac and what is a statist? Statist is, I would define as a person who subscribes to a mythical belief that, aggression, threats, and theft can be used to provide protection and services to the very same people that are the targets of that aggression. So that sounds pretty far-fetched, but it's actually pretty popular. So I really feel like people should be trying to engage people who have this mythical belief. And I think that their fundamentalism or extremism becomes very evident when you try to explain to them the philosophy of liberty, or the principle of non-aggression, because they immediately encounter two problems. You know, the first is, they really can't say that it's wrong. That's hard, right? Somebody explains the non-aggression principle, the idea that it's wrong to initiate force against peaceful people. I think anybody here who's ever tried to explain that to somebody probably never got back, "Oh, that's dumb." Right? Like, so something else has to happen. Right? Because people can't really say that. They can't really argue against that. But the other problem is that it pretty much invalidates everything that they believe about government, if they think about it. And that becomes incredibly problematic for them. So, because I've spent a lot of time, whether it was friends or family or colleagues, engaged in these debates and engaged in these, conversations, I've come up with some patterns that are pretty predictable. Usually what happens first is they go into like a strike mode. And there's kind of this accidental cleverness in statism where they can set these question traps for you. Like, all right, well, let's say that you were in charge. Okay, I resign. All right, well, let's say you have a system, so you need to have a system. So you're critical of this system, this public education system. So what's your idea for a system that can take its place? Well, I mean, the only thing that can really take the place of the public education system is it would be something that would be shockingly similar to it, right? So really the question is, how would you take other people's money by force and then use it to provide a service to millions of strangers in perpetuity? And it's kind of like, well, hold on, let me go find somebody who's insane enough to think that they could answer a question like that, right? I mean, all politicians think that they can, but it's not an answerable question. But that's one of the traps that's set for us. And Murray Rothbard said one time, or he wrote one time in
Ethics of Liberty, one of the chapters begins with him pointing out the fact that, I mean, it's obvious, but it's worth pointing out because I think it's a considerable disadvantage, or people have made it into a considerable disadvantage, that every conversation or every debate between state versus no state has to exist in a context where the state is already there. Chapter 23, just so you don't think I'm making that up. The inner contradictions of the state, that's the chapter. So this seems to be a problem that I think many people find insurmountable, right? Because it's so easy to catastrophize against things that haven't even come into existence yet, right? In favor of what is already known and what is already comfortable, right? Like, let's pretend for a minute that, you know, you have a blueprint. It's 1860. You have a blueprint for an internal combustion engine in your hands. You take it up to a group of people, you say, hey, I'm really confident that what I have here could revolutionize personal transportation. I can explain it to you how it works, soup to nuts, in 180 minutes. Well, most people are like, no, too long, see ya, right? And you lose most of your audience. They want it in a, people like quick summaries. But let's pretend that whoever stays, whoever wants to continue this explanation of the internal combustion engine, this thing that will revolutionize transportation, the people who are staying are people who coincidentally invest about 50% of their income into the future of the horse-drawn carriage industry. Let's even pretend that they're forced to do it, because I don't know how that would happen, but let's just pretend that they're forced to do it. Okay, so they have this other problem where they have to make the horse-drawn carriage industry awesome in their head to deal with that conflict of the fact that they're forced to do it. So you lose even, this is just not a captive audience for this internal combustion engine demonstration. So whoever sits there and listens to this, at the end, I think the Q&A session would be extraordinarily difficult for the person giving the presentation. And you would get things like, well, gasoline? You want these things to run on gasoline? Where's gasoline going to come from? And what if you were out driving in the middle of nowhere and you ran out of gasoline and you'd be stranded? Then what would you do? And why would you want to mess around with a flammable liquid when horses work just fine? And where are we going to get gasoline? Hay is what the horses eat, and that grows everywhere. So I don't even know what you're talking about. And like, if your answer was something like, well, you know, I think that innovative people in a free market could figure out a way to solve that problem. Oh, that's your answer for everything. That's all you have to say. You see the convenience for me to pick something that every problem was already solved. But when this type of discussion happens in the realm of politics, or happens in the realm of economics, or in education, we can really see the effects of people's government education, this 12-year positive affirmation of the status quo that's just so littered with these ceremonies of worship for these coercive institutions. And in my show, I've talked about these three lessons that I believe are embedded into the entire curriculum, into that 12-year process. Obedience, conformity, and apathy. And how they all seem to be channeled into this acceptance or rationalization for things that exist as they exist. And I even think the recipients of this kind of training are pretty good at tricking themselves. Like, I'll take you back in time a year, and like, even though they're so comfortable with the way things are, and any significant change would petrify them, they're pretty good at tricking themselves into thinking that they like change. Right? They'll say, we're going back 1 year in time. I'm actually for change. I actually want things to change. So I vote for Obama. Take you back 9 years in time. I like change. I want change. So I vote for Bush. 17 years. I don't want to go all the way back to Washington, right? But you get the idea. So the disadvantage of existence, that we have. Like Rothbard was saying, that this is something that is difficult for us because we have to argue in this context where statism exists and what we're talking about doesn't. It shows up in other conversations as well, and I think a lot of people who argue from that point of view think existence, the existence of something, is often like the clincher for them. I don't know if you've ever had a discussion like this. Let's say it's 30 minutes long. So at the beginning, you're expressing your ideas and you're crazy because all this stuff that you're against is good. It's good. These things are good. This is important. This is virtuous. This is education, right? Those taxes pay for services, right? It's all great stuff. But 10 minutes later, in that same conversation with that same person, their tune has changed a little bit. And now those things are not good, but necessary. Right? So you see this progression. They've gone from, it was good when you started, but after you kind of put in some of your ideas, now these things are necessary. Alright? So then they go from there, right? But 10 minutes later in that same conversation, they've changed again, their argument. Now, they're like, hey man, that's the law. Hey man, that's the tax code. Hey man, that's democracy. Hey man, that's reality. That's the way it is. Pretty much. So it's almost like something is justifiable if there's a way of explaining it, or if it has a name. And I mean, if you think about how insane that is, I mean, imagine the chaos of a world that was governed by that logic. You know, you're walking down the street, someone comes up and uppercuts you in the face. Hey man, punch in the face. Yeah, it hurts, it's embarrassing, you don't know what to do. That's the nature of the thing. Take care of yourself. But we can see this allegiance to the way it is. Now, of course, the punch in the face is a silly example, right? And sometimes this might happen all within a half an hour. But sometimes that same progression of rationalization can take hundreds of years, like with slavery, okay? In let's say, 1600s, right? The sentiment about slavery from apologists and plantations owners was, oh, this is, you know, it's really good what we're doing. We're taking care of these people. We're giving them something to do. Teach them about Jesus. And then by the first decades, the early decades of the 1800s, it was like, this is necessary. The entire Southern economy is based on slavery. If we got rid of slavery, all this bad stuff would happen. The economy would collapse and all of these other catastrophes. But right up to the end, it was like, at the very end, it was like, hey, it's always been there. It's always been there. We couldn't operate without it. So that progression can happen two ways. I've often heard people say that once you can show people that something is evil, that evil will cease to exist. Is people familiar with that? Okay. And I think that upstairs last year, Stefan Molyneux gave a really terrific example of a strategy for how to do that with the against me argument, right? Because there's nothing you can say to that. There's no place where you can go from there. And I agree with that progression, right? Like, the first step is showing people the evil. Eventually the evil will not exist. But from my experience, I've realized that there's a very, very important intermediate step that most people, I think, unfortunately find insurmountable. And that is, once something is shown to be evil, that evil has to be made to be necessary. Right? Because the rationalizations, they have to continue. Because we already have, as statists, we already have a comfortable conclusion. So we're not changing that. And I felt this way for so long that I'm really just not backing away from this at this point. And I think that brings up another appearance of the impact of government education. In school, we start with conclusions. Lessons start with conclusions. It's basically a milieu where you are a little kid. You don't know anything. The person who wrote the book or the person at the front of the room knows everything. And if you sit still and quiet, they'll tell you about it. Right? But the conclusions are already made. And I, you know, I make it sound like this is something that only happens in elementary school, but I was recently working with a high school student. And he had this project that he had to do on climate change. Anybody heard anything about this?
I voted for it.
And, you know, the project was interesting. It's like one example. I don't mean to pillage too much from a future podcast where I rant about this for an hour, but I think this is worth covering. There's this chart, right? XY standard graph, which shows, you know, X is time, Y is something going up or down. And it's parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So this is the chart that they're given to deal with the topic of climate change. And what you see is this steep line of more carbon appearing in the atmosphere over the course of 10 years. When you look at the numbers on the y-axis, or the x-axis, or the, yeah, no, I'm sorry, the y-axis, the up and down, you usually think about the bottom at the origin being zero, and then the top being some much higher value. When you look a little bit closer, you realize that the very bottom number on this chart is 350. And the very top number is 370. Parts per million. And the line that goes like this, right? So you just see the amount of, the lack, rather, of respect that the person who made that chart had for the intelligence of the people who received it. But when you, the way the project went is, after you're done with your investigation of like, oh, is man infecting, affecting the environment? Let's find out, right, where the conclusion is already reached, right? So they say, find somebody in the class who agrees with you. Not disagrees with you, right? So kind of putting forward this idea that everybody's going to agree, so it'll be easy to find somebody who agrees with you. And discuss what you found and where you agree. No debate, nothing. And that's pretty standard. I mean, I don't do much work with the sciences, but if you want to go to history, this happens even more frequently. All the conclusions are already there. So I think that this idea of existence is an important idea to explore as a disadvantage, just to get back on track. People have always considered this to be a trouble spot, an impediment to making these arguments. I started to think that perhaps this is actually one of the biggest advantages that we have, that statism exists for these arguments. Obviously, it's a tremendous disadvantage for society, for the planet Earth, for everything else. But now, the thought experiment is somewhat of a fantasy, and I think it would be kind of difficult to execute in a real situation, but interesting nonetheless. And I thought I would share it here. It was actually going to be the next episode of the show, but I thought it would be worth sharing here, where hopefully we can leave some time for discussion. If we don't have time now, we can certainly do it later, where this idea is kind of undeveloped. So I wanted to put it out there. I wanted to get some feedback if people could augment it or change it or tweak it a little bit. I think that would be great, but I thought this would make a good place to present it with everyone here, you know, sharing these ideas. Now, my experience with, you know, status friends, colleagues, family has led to a lot of frustration, really from getting nowhere. But it's also led to, like, a lot of dismay from watching people that not only that I care about, but who are kind and intelligent and thoughtful, like, rationalize and participate in and support the violence of strangers who do not care about them. It can be really upsetting. And the fact that they pretend that it's voluntary, too. It sucks. It's hard to watch this. It's hard to have those kinds of conversations. But then after one of these heated discussions, I realized something. That no one who ever put up any resistance, who would ever put up any resistance to anything I said, no matter how smart they were, how experienced they were, how old they were, had ever produced a rational counter-argument against anything I had ever said. Think about that for a moment. I started to think about what all these interactions had in common. And it was the employment of a deeply, deeply flawed rhetorical device that they all seemed to be using, maybe by accident, of deeply imaginative, emotion and fear-driven catastrophes that might result if my philosophy became a reality. And it's usually, at first, it's usually packaged in a new series of questions, like, what if, that begin with what if, and then, of course, the what about questions that we're all familiar with, like, what about the roads? And what if somebody dangerous gets a nuclear weapon? Right? Because now nobody dangerous has nuclear weapons. What if somebody punches you in the face? What if somebody's dog bites you? How would you get water? So basically, what they want to do is they want to take whatever you're saying and they want to just wipe that clean and instead replace it with this vision of my society where we're all driving our cars through the woods in the middle of a perpetual nuclear war being fought by gangs. And this is catastrophizing. This is what catastrophizing is. And of course, conventional wisdom is known, it's comfortable. For most people, unfortunately, it's good enough.
The argument from apocalypse.
Exactly. That's as it's been called. The catastrophizing or the argument from apocalypse. So we not only take on, in this pursuit, we're not only taking on the fear of the unknown, but we're also taking on the comfort with what they have as it exists now. So anytime we have to have these discussions, as Rothbard pointed out, we have to play their game on their field, by their rules, with their language. And people have, like I said, have always considered this to be a huge disadvantage. So what if in these discussions, and this is my idea, and like I said, do with it what you will, we could have a mirror of sorts that we could use. And if you think about most of these debates on politics, what pretty much happens is, like when people, Republicans and Democrats, debate, they pretty much, plant their feet firmly on one side of the hypocritical and irrational political spectrum, and they just kind of hurl their feces at each other until they're exhausted. And whatever family dinner or neighborhood party that was going on in the background that they hadn't been paying attention to for a couple hours is completely ruined. And this is what most people are used to. Oh, you know what? I think it's funny too that if you see people having discussions like this, go and jump in. And just kind of sit on the sidelines and lob your ideas. Like, just when you get a chance. And they're spitting on each other, and they're very red, usually. But just start lobbing your ideas in, casually. And what you'll find within a matter of minutes is that these two people who are about to grab each other's throats are suddenly best friends. They're holding hands. They're united against you. Like, hey, nobody's going to come and inject a bunch of logic and reasoning and morality into a perfectly good turd-throwing contest. But this is what most people are used to, these, very firmly planted feet, not interested in, they're not even listening to each other, right? They're talking past each other and over each other. And you can see the look on someone's face when somebody's talking, and there you just see that look like, oh my God, I can't wait till I can get to talk again. I'm thinking what I'm going to say, I know what I'm going to say. Not even listening, I mean, that's... But imagine this. Think about how bewildering it would be if during one of these discussions that one of you were having with the status, you said, hey, you know what? Let's switch places. Right. Silence, of course, right? Now, this would certainly catch them off guard. Maybe it caught some of you off guard. Like, what do you mean? You'd have their attention, though. And this is not how political debates work. We don't suddenly switch sides nor consider other people's points of view. It's like, simple. We plant feet, poop in hand. Right? So there's no, like, considering what other people's opinions are. I said, no. I think you misunderstood what I'm saying. I don't mean switch sides. I mean switch places. It's a little different. It might be good at this point to stop and explain what it is that you, arguing from the libertarian position, are doing. And basically, you've put out some kind of base principle for us, the principle of non-aggression, the idea that it's wrong to initiate force against innocent people. And you built up a belief system above that, that can apply to any of these political or economic or educational or societal discussions that go on. And then say to the person, now, since we seem to disagree on so much, your belief system must have some kind of very, very different underlying principle. So what I'd like to do for just 5 minutes, just humor me, is I want to pretend that your ideas are new and weird and uncomfortable. And I want to be somebody who, no matter what anybody says to me, can only respond with some kind of fear-based, catastrophe-driven what-if scenario. And let's see how that goes. I think, what's the best way to do this? How are we doing on time, by the way? Someone?
In about 40 minutes.
Oh, really? Okay, so we'll do this quick. I'll give you an idea of what this might look like. And this is, again, as I said, this is a bit of a fantasy. This would be very difficult to get an actual statist to give these answers. But the first thing, the most important thing is that you identify some kind of underlying principle for the belief system, and then they have to articulate that, and then you can catastrophize against it. So they might start out by saying something like, what we need to do is set up a system where some people have, like, a privilege to aggress against other people, and they'll use that privilege to provide the people they aggress against with protection and services. Let me stop you right there, because as a very fearful person, statist, I can already envision some catastrophes that might result from opening that door. Don't you think that would just lead to incredible power disparity and predation and destruction and murder if you went that way? And then maybe back to them, they would say, well, there's ways, you see, that you can prevent that. That might happen sometimes. But what you can do to prevent that would be, like, you keep the organization of people who can do this very, very, very small. Okay, which is one side of the political spectrum. Or you make sure that it's always populated with, like, virtuous, honest, caring people who care so much about the well-being of others. Which might be the other side of the aisle. Well, as the catastrophizer, I'd like to take the second part first. What if the kind of power that this organization has would only attract people who are not virtuous? People who see, like you said, they have a privilege of aggression. And when you say privilege of aggression, I picture, like, theft. And I picture threats to back up that theft so they can do whatever they want to do. And if necessary, I picture violence to back up the threats. And the idea that kind of thing would stay very small, to take the first part second, I don't see that happening. I see that coerced power only winding up in the hands of the most dangerous kinds of people. And then that just, you know, expanding outward forever. Well, okay, sure, that could happen, but what we'd want to do at the beginning is have them write down some rules for themselves on paper and keep it someplace safe. I don't mean to be so fearful, and I don't mean to be so negative, but with all this power they have, and this privilege of aggression, what if they decide they don't want to follow those rules? And you know, maybe it's even not that simple. Like fear is powerful, right? Like, maybe just because I'm so, maybe what you're saying, statist, is completely rational. It's just logically flawless. And because I'm just such a fearful person, I'm having trouble seeing the logic. Now, think about how fear could be used. Like, if there was a crisis, and a crisis came up, and people were very fearful, they might accept the people in that organization breaking those rules for protection or for additional services. And I don't see that going anywhere good either over time. Well, the people would have to be vigilant. They'd have to want to keep a watchful eye over these people. But it would be very, very important to make sure that people were well-educated so they could spot these things before they happened, you see. I don't know why I decided on this, like, 1930s accent. But at this point, I think I'm going to take it to the end, okay? And if people are educated and informed, then those kind of things that you're so afraid of can't happen. Well, what if those very same people somehow were able to, like, take the idea of education, this lifelong pursuit of intrinsically motivated new knowledge integration, and they were able to turn it into like a public service that they control. Then what?
Now, I just have to interrupt the speech here for 1 minute. At this point, the statist reveals, statist also played by me, reveals to the catastrophizer that they have had a gun the whole time, and at this final question that they can't answer, they pull out the gun. I didn't actually have a gun. I just made it out of my fingers. But a little bit of visual information that you would probably need for the rest of the speech to make sense. And hey, maybe that's why they were talking in that 1930s gangster movie accent the whole time, too. All right, enjoy.
I was hoping they wouldn't come today. But you just kept asking questions. And this, in my hand, is pretty much the end of every argument for statism. Because it's the only thing that's powerful enough and intimidating enough to back up something that is based on nothing rational. And I know this is kind of a messy idea right now, because I thought of it like 2 days ago. But I hope that there's something in it that you can take, an idea that you can take, and maybe incorporate it into some of the discussions that you have on the topics of politics or economics or education. And I think what's most important is that the catastrophes that Republicans and Democrats or statists have to employ to counter our philosophy need to be retrieved from the deepest and darkest corners of the human imagination. The catastrophes that we have to employ to counter their ideology can be retrieved in history and reality everywhere. That's it. So with whatever time we have left, questions, thoughts? Yes.
I have never listened to your show, so I don't know exactly. I mean, I'm a public school teacher, and I see what's wrong with it, but I don't know if what I think is wrong is the same thing that you think is wrong. I support vouchers. I support the fact that the money should follow the child. What exactly is your philosophy? Like, why do you see public school as such a horrible thing?
I have a feeling this might be our only question, folks.
I don't like the way it's going either, but...
Well, would you say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, would you think that maybe part of the problem is a lack of funding?
No.
Okay. All right. Good. I don't think vouchers are a good idea. I see that as a Trojan horse to put more control, more government control in the hands of more control of private school in the hands of the government. And I see that as really a power play by the teachers union. I think that if the money that people pay in property tax was then like distributed out or given back to people to use for their education, the cry would be, well, that's public money, right? Because once the government takes the money, it's their money. So they would say, if public money is going to these private institutions, then there needs to be all this new oversight over those institutions if they're going to be receiving public money. And I think that the teachers unions would also jump into that and say, well, if these private school teachers are going to be receiving public money, they need to be held up to our rigorous standards. but I think that would be what would happen. My problem with education, which I didn't, I hope nobody minds, I didn't talk too much about it today, more about what I see as strategies for dealing with the impacts of government education, but I think that the government school system essentially now in America and as it has existed in other places post-Enlightenment is basically designed as a conduit that runs from the ideas and beliefs of central planners and intellectuals right into the minds of impressionable children. And I think if we use what happened in Prussia that became the Weimar, that became Nazi Germany, that's probably the best case study of where a government-run education system goes. I think it teaches, like I said in the speech, obedience, apathy, and conformity, because it's trying to produce a predictable populace. Right? Now, I understand that this sounds like a conspiracy theory, but if you think about how small a group of people is that are trying to manage an entire society, it would almost be insane for them not to do this. Right? Now, religion works towards this end for a better part of 1,000 years, right? Because when people subscribed to a very strict dogma, they were very predictable. Like when something happened, it would be known how they would feel, how they would believe. And I think that education in the last 150 years has replaced religion as a tool for producing a predictable populace for the convenience of the government.
It is a religion.
It
is a religion.
Yeah, they're trying to set up themselves as a religion.
Yes, I agree.
So you've given kind of a theoretical talk, and I do like your theories, but from students themselves, what are like the top two or three things that really burn them that they really hate?
That would be a very difficult question for me to answer. I mean, I think it would be highly, highly variable. Yeah. And I would hesitate to generalize. Oh, all right. Well, then you guys go ahead.
So, two or three things that I would say that I hate the most about public schools: the lack of originality the teachers like want from students. I've had countless times where I've written papers and I've been marked down just because my ideas were different from the teachers. Mm-hmm. I've written papers on just like different policy changes. And teachers will tell me I can't do that because it's against the law. It's stuff like that. That's something stupid. The lack of vastness in what we're learning. When we learn history, we learn one side of history. We don't learn a broad history spectrum. We just learn what they want us to learn. And I learned so much more by going here than I have in all the years that I've gone to school. Like.
You'll learn what we want you to learn.
Well, I gotta tell you though that you like losing credit because you're not putting down on paper exactly what the teacher wants you to is excellent preparation for college. but I definitely agree with what you're saying, and you know you spoke about the conformity piece, that the encouragement or there's discouragement for originality. Or for your ideas. I see that a lot, too. And I think that the dual nature of school is that it's this simultaneous construction and demolition project. It's the destruction of the individual, and it's the construction of a myth. Somebody said religion, which I've used that term before, too, of the state. And how you do that at the same time, that seems tricky, but it gets done. But I don't think that this is a problem that's insurmountable. I think I'm very, very open to you know, other people's solutions, and I think I get very, very caught up in the idea of unschooling, which I think is the ideal for how education should work. But as I was talking to people last night, I often, as my attraction to unschooling often leads me to overlook the fact that over 90% of children are still in government schools. And the transition might have to be a little bit more gradual than that. Anything else? All the way in the back?
Which is precisely what the next session is all about.
I will be there. I will be there. You in the front there, Madison. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to give you an example. Last year, I took a cruise around South America, and on several occasions, I was with people that were bashing Bush to get political here. And so, on both occasions, I asked them, well, what is so bad about Bush? One worked at the FAA in Washington, D.C., and she thought he was the most horrible person in the world. And so I said to her, well, okay, help me understand here. What didn't you like about him? What was so bad? I want to talk about it. So then the other people that I had dinner with were doing the same thing. They were bashing Bush. And I tried to put them on the spot and say, okay, what is wrong with him? What has he done? I can't talk about it. So I learned from that that the liberals can't voice their own opinion. All they can do is tear down and criticize.
Well, you know, I think this might not be the best response to that, but what it made me think of is, like, when somebody wakes up in the morning and, you know, they've had a good education and they've had a decent upbringing, and they say, what I want is a career where I can, like, take money from people by force and use it to punish my enemies and reward my friends. I'm really not particularly concerned with what letter they put after their name when they're on television. I think you know everything about them that you already need to know when that's their MO. So, not to get away. Anything else? You in the back.
I was going to ask, if part of the problem with children going to public schools is that their parents generally support the idea, so would you support that children should segregate themselves or separate themselves from their parents in order to avoid public schools?
I wouldn't encourage people. I have a very difficult time encouraging anybody or really saying anybody should do anything. I think that's a case-by-case basis. I mean, if some people have particularly destructive familial relationships, then yeah. But as a way of proceeding forward, no, I wouldn't say that. And am I answering that, or am I missing something?
It's just following from Stefan Molyneux has talked about how some students or some young people should remove themselves from their status parents to avoid the problems with.
I think some people might need to do that. But I don't think that it's a foregone conclusion that's necessary to get where we want to go. I think, you know, we can have relationships with people where we try to be honest and open with them, and we try to show them the herd of elephants that are walking around in our house. And you know, depending on the response that you get back, as you try to, you know, be honest with your family and, or even improve those relationships or make them more genuine, I just think that if you don't get back what you want, I wouldn't say you necessarily need to, never talk to that person again. I think you can just, adjust the importance of that relationship. And I might differ with Steph on that a little bit. I don't know too much about his position. But I think that, like I said, I think that in your mind you can adjust the importance of those relationships if they're not what you need. Yeah.
I just want to speak off of that. If you can't gradually convince your family, you won't convince the world of anything. Maybe they'll never believe your belief system. You'll eventually be 18 and out of the house. But if you can't talk with your family about issues or just keep trying, you won't be able to do that in the world when you get out into the world. Because it's not just your family, it's everyone.
I think sometimes family is a disadvantage. I think when people have seen you as a little child, right? Because they've been having this, like, I'm a little bit more than 30 years old. My family has been having the exact same conversation my entire life. Right now, the names and situations have changed, but it's the same conversation. Now, when the conversation started, I was in diapers, and I didn't know anything. And now I ask them a bunch of questions that they can't answer. And I think that that's a disadvantage sometimes in presenting these ideas. Like, yeah, your family, should care about you and love you more than anyone else, and they should be supportive. And I felt like, in most ways, my family has been incredibly supportive. Even about, the things they disagree with me on. Some of them not so much. But I think it's easier almost sometimes to take these things to people who are not family, who've only ever seen you as an adult. Right? So they don't have that image of you as a little kid. And I think what you're saying is partially true, that if those relationships are really, really, really strong and really, really, really supportive, it should be easy to convince somebody of something that's obvious, right? But I think, again, different people, different situations.
The point is the discussion never ends.
Exactly.
An hour.
Is that so now? Oh, all right. Thanks, everyone, for coming.